KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and this coming year a visiting research collaborator at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Today I'm very excited to have on Wendell Wallach, the author of the just-released book, A Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control. Wendell has written a fascinating study of the levers and instrumentalities necessary to deal with the very real potential problem of technology moving beyond our ability to control it and our ability to even understand what it does. For those of you that have listened to Hearsay Culture with some regularity, we've more recently started discussing both artificial intelligence and robotics with people like Ryan Kahlo and Woody Hartzog and Peter Asaro. In Wendell's book and study, he takes what I think is a fairly balanced but definitely critical look at how we introduce these new technologies into society and where the problems are or the concerns would be about making sure that these technologies are used in a socially beneficial way. And so not only is Wendell focusing on the substance of what these technologies are and the capabilities, but I think personally, even more importantly, is focusing on the procedural side of how we make decisions and analyze technologies, not only from a governmental perspective, but also from a private sector perspective. Increasingly on Hearsay Culture, regular listeners know that we have more and more focused on procedure. And that's been a conscious choice on my part because as I've looked at the range of technological policy concerns that we've had, from the copyright and access information questions through robotics, through surveillance, through privacy, at least in my estimation, there is heavy focus on the substance, but there's not nearly enough focus, in my view, on the procedures that get to that substance. How is it that we decide, if we decide at all, that a particular technology should be used a certain way, that that private industry can or should do what they're doing, or even, for that matter, how does private industry decide to do what they decide to do or not do? And so these procedural questions, I think, deserve enormous amount of attention. They are difficult topics, not only because they tend to be inside baseball, people don't quite have a frame of reference, but also because some people view them as simply boring procedural stuff. But Hearsay Culture, because it's my show and it's a show that is sponsored by the Center for Internet Society and that is supported by KZSU and aired by KZSU, my view is, where else are you going to have these discussions except through shows that are aired on nonprofit radio stations like KZSU, where I don't have to worry about a advertiser wanting to buy or not buy advertising. Hearsay Culture has a strong listenership, and I think it's in part because we discuss these issues that don't often get a lot of attention. Clearly, robotics and the introduction of new technologies is getting increasing attention, and yet it is fair to say that the robotics scholarly focus is still in its nascent stages. This is one reason why I think Wendell's book is so important for us to discuss and why we're going to focus on it today. When you think about a dangerous master, right, the notion of having these robot overlords, as I think became a fairly famous quote from the Jeopardy episode involving the IBM computer that beat Jeopardy champions, and then the Jeopardy champion, whose name escapes me right now, I think fairly famously said, I for one welcome our new robot overlords. This idea of being mastered or controlled by robotics is one that science fiction has developed over a period of decades, but now, as Wendell points out, is, in his view, not necessarily something that would be limited to science fiction and, in fact, is possible. So in this discussion, we are going to talk about the dangers that about Wendell's concern, what the role of expertise is, and really how we deal with this introduction. By way of very brief background, and as usual, I will ask Wendell to amplify this, he is a consultant, ethicist, and scholar at Yale University's Interdisciplinary Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics. He is the co-author of his previous book, Moral Machines, Teaching Robots Right from Wrong. He is joining us on July 7, 2015 via Skype from his home in Connecticut. Wendell, thank you so much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wendell, let's start off with a question, as I mentioned, that I ask most of my authors. Tell us a bit more about your background and why you chose to write this book now.
Well, I've been in the midst of the culture around emerging technologies for pretty much 15 years or so. And during that time, it's become clear to me that there was no good entertaining overview of the emerging technologies. So as I'm mentioning emerging technologies, let me be clear that the book goes way beyond information technologies, artificial intelligence, robotics, to talk about nanotechnologies, biotechnologies, geoengineering, and a vast array of other issues. So there was no good overview, and therefore I thought no good way for scientifically literate adults to enter into a broad appreciation for what was going on here. Secondly, it was clear to me in my role chairing the Technology and Ethics Study Group at Yale that there was very little going on as far as oversight of these emerging technologies. In fact, innovation was moving far ahead of oversight. So that was of great concern. And finally, I was hearing too much about inevitability and futility in trying to manage the development of technology. So I want to counteract that trend.
So Wendell, let me dig a little deeper, because you mentioned up front there the broad range of technologies, and it's true that I focused on one important but only one area about which you focus. What therefore is technology in your view? And that is a classic academic question, I admit, but how would you define technology, and how do you define technology in the book?
Well, I really use technology in the broadest of sense. So I'm really contrasting technology to scientific discovery. So where by scientific discovery is the uncovering of knowledge, technology becomes the application of that knowledge to do something, to make some change in the world, or to make something happen in the world. So in that sense, technology becomes a truly broad category. Of course, there are some areas in which scientific discovery happens through technology. So we can think of this in terms of systems like particle colliders or fMRIs. So in that sense, the discovery and the technology are one and the same.
Now, you mentioned an acronym there, and I want to be sure, the second one. What was that? The fMRIs.
Oh, the fMRIs. So the fMRIs refer to brain scanning devices. So most of the pictures you see of what seems to be activity taking place in different parts of the brain, those take place through various different scanning technologies, and fMRI referred to a kind of scanning technology that can actually look at changes over time, if only crudely.
So let me, and this is, you know, you're dealing with a contracts professor, so I do this. I like parsing words. But I think it's important, particularly when we're talking about a emerging area. When your subtitle is How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control, I just want to be clear about this. Who is the our that you're thinking about here?
Well, I truly am using our to refer to humanity in general. But I think, you know, that's probably too broad a category, so I'm focusing the book at basically informed, concerned citizens who would like to jump in and participate in the conversation about technological development. So that's informed citizens, some experts, helping them develop expertise beyond the areas in which they specialize with, and of course also policy planners.
And so I'll ask that similar question in light of that answer. What do we mean by control in the context of this broad definition of technology?
Well, what I mean by control is just that technology starts to become a determinant of who we are, what we'll become. I think self-driving cars give an apt metaphor for that. There's a sense that technology is moving into the driver's seat as the primary determinant of human destiny.
And so can you be a little more specific as to what that means in the context of this definition of hour?
Well, in the context of the definition of hour, I'm just saying that the technology sometimes becomes so entrenched, or the forces behind its continuing on whatever course it happens to be on so strong that we lose the ability to alter its course in any concerted way. Or if we try to alter its course, we can only do so with tremendous effort. So this is sometimes referred to as the Collingridge dilemma, which is basically that the course of technology is easiest to alter early in its development, but oftentimes early in its development, it's very hard to know what its societal impact will be. And oftentimes by the time its challenges, its risks are recognized, it's so entrenched that it becomes very difficult to alter its course. And the Collingridge dilemma has more or less been taken as a sacrosanct principle in technology and policies for quite a few years now. And I and other people in this broader field of what's sometimes called anticipatory ethics or responsible innovation think that, no, there's an inflection point. There's a period in there between the recognition of the problems and before the technology gets truly entrenched, when you recognize the difficulties and there are still opportunities, inflection points, windows, which may stay open for a long time or a very short time, in which you can truly alter the course of technological development.
So I want to ask you about our current abilities to control technology broadly in a moment, because I think in order to take what may sound to some like some abstract concerns to a very practical and real level, you open a book with what sounds like a science fiction existential crisis, and yet there were some very smart people who viewed it as a least real possibility. What is, if you could tell that story and kind of contextualize it around the dangerous master concept that you identify?
So readers or listeners had probably heard about the Large Hadron Collider, which is the largest particle collider in the world, and it operates or is overseen by a group called CERN, and it's functioning out of Switzerland. And just before they were about to turn on this machine, Otto Rössler, a celebrated biochemist, not a physicist, but a biochemist, came out with a charge that turning on the Large Hadron Collider could actually create a tiny little black hole, and that tiny black hole would slowly begin to suck up the planet Earth until it would disappear. So in effect, he was saying that turning on the Large Hadron Collider could signal the end of the Earth, the end of humanity. And though he didn't get a lot of people to join on board with him, there were significant numbers of other people. There were theoretical reasons to believe black holes could be created. And this got the engineering community, and particularly the physicists, to think about, well, could this really happen? And they did some analysis and came out with three reasons why they felt it would not happen. Or that even if a black hole was created, it would disintegrate, disappear almost instantaneously. So it was not really something to be fearful of. And therefore, they went ahead and turned on the Large Hadron Collider after a court decided that they could do so. That court, by the way, made that decision within 3 days. So it was basically just following on the viewpoint of the experts. So this was just an example where somebody flagged a possible danger, a truly existential risk, one that could eliminate humanity. And the scientists more or less analyzed and decided that it was wrong.
So this gets back to this definition of control and what we mean by the ability to control technology. In this story, which as you identify, is an existential crisis, and therefore, in a sense, is a somewhat easier one to analyze where you're risking the existence of the planet, right? The concern that you have, and correct me if I'm misunderstanding, the dangerous master here is the effects of the technology as opposed to the creation of the technologies themselves. And the reason I frame it this way is that there is certainly a lot of discussion in the tech sector about technologies that shouldn't be created or technologies that shouldn't be studied because the technologies themselves are dangerous. And we can put them in the context of, compared to the existence of the planet, trivial issues like peer-to-peer technologies, which allow people to share information for example, songs and movies in an unauthorized manner. And we say, well, the technology, at least industry has argued, that peer-to-peer technology should be banned because the technology affects piracy versus, right, you can have the technology, but we should regulate its use. When you think about technology itself, broadly speaking, are you of the opinion that there are technologies that should simply never be created in the first instance or studied, or are you more of the view that we can develop technologies, but we need to control how they're used, or perhaps there's a third view, which is we can't control some of these technologies? So where do you I recognize, given your broad definition of technology, that you'd want to granularize it, but if you think about your perspective going in, where do you tend to put yourself?
Well, I basically put myself as being a pragmatist. I just don't think you can stop technology or the arguments against scientific discovery because it might produce a dangerous technologies don't always hold water, and the same scientific discovery may actually provide means to manage the very technology that we're exploring. But that said, I think there are certain technologies that we should regulate or we should only look at very carefully, and only if we do think we can manage their development that it won't get out of hand. So an example of that would be geoengineering. Some kinds of geoengineering is a term to refer to any technological means to mitigate the effect of global climate change. So even just painting rooftops white to reflect sunlight away can be thought of as a geoengineering technique. But there are forms of geoengineering, such as seeding the atmosphere with sulfates to reflect sunlight away and perhaps mitigate as much as 50% of the temperature rise every year, that potentially could upset climate patterns in as dramatic and dangerous ways as climate change or carbon is presently. So I think that's a kind of technology I wouldn't necessarily say that we should absolutely rule out, but if we're going to look at it at all, we should test and be very clear that we know what we're doing before we jump into it whole hog.
We're chatting with Wendell Wallach, author of the book A Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control, just recently published by Basic Books on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So I think you just alluded to it, Wendell, but I want to be absolutely clear about this. As opposed to those existential crises, and as you talked about, the development of the atomic bomb would be another, right, where you risk fires in the atmosphere, as you wrote about, or you risk the disappearance of the planet, there are technologies where it's unclear what the risks are, or just simply technologies, as I alluded to, that don't have those kinds of potential enormous harms. Is there an example of a harder question in terms of deciding what to do that you like to identify when you think about these questions of risk, which I want to talk about in more detail in a moment?
Well, let's talk about a risk that's been getting a little bit of attention recently. And when I'm talking about risks, it's not, of course, just existential risks. It's any kind of impact. I particularly focus on technologies that are not necessarily existential risks, but do have a broad societal impact, and not necessarily in an explicit danger that the technology creates, but in how the technology itself impacts the society around it. So the one that's been getting a lot of attention recently is technological unemployment, which is this impact of developing technologies to put a downward pressure on wage growth and job growth, often attributed primarily to robots, but robots aren't the only factor in this case. But let's just take robots as an example. By some analyses, as much as 47% of existing U.S. jobs are subject to computerization. That's a dramatic number of jobs that could be computerized. And just imagine that if mere 2% of those were computerized every year, what effect that would have on the availability of jobs and the overall political economy of the United States. So that's an example of something where the robots themselves aren't dangerous, at least not in this context, but the overall impact of the society could be truly profound, and we should be looking at sooner rather than later to see if there's some ways that we could mitigate that impact or slow it down if that was what we had decided.
And so you use the word decided, which is a nice segue into the, again, a broad topic before we drill down in a little more detail. All right, you know, risk analysis plays a major role in the stories that you tell. But when you think about this problem, as you alluded to it, it's ultimately a problem of making decisions, as I mentioned in the introduction. Give us an overview before we dig deeper of your procedural concerns involving these issues. In other words, if there are risks that exist, what are the problems that you see in our ability to assess them?
Well, I think most of these problems tend to become political and not merely scientific. So in the example of the Large Hadron Collider, that was more or less a scientific decision to be made by the experts because they were dealing in an area of physics where you can more or less predict what will happen, presuming we know the laws of physics that impinge upon the system being discussed. Well, as soon as you start talking about systems or technologies that interface with human actors, then you're really in the political realm where you can do a certain degree of risk analysis or cost-benefit analysis. These are two different formal tools we have for trying illuminating some of what the risks are or some of what the trade-offs will be. But ultimately, those just become ways of illuminating some of the concerns, but finally a decision has to be made, and there a lot of political factors come into the decision-making process. What concerns me is that the political factors that come in are often very myopic, looking at, let's say, one dimension, such as whether you think that technology will increase productivity and whether any pressures to slow technology will slow productivity. And we do not look comprehensively. In fact, there's nobody looking comprehensively at the development of nearly any technology. We are a society of specialists. We are the society of people living in their own silos, whether those are political or academic. And we very seldom go outside of those silos to take a truly comprehensive view of the many factors, players, and forces that impinge upon how a technology will develop and how it will impact our society.
So you've made a broad claim there, Wendell, and I don't want to push back as much as press on it a little bit. To the extent that you can say we have no comprehensive analysis, would you classify the internet as a technology that at this point, right? So in other words, now in 2015, as opposed to, which maybe is your point, when the internet was actually foisted upon the public, right? Do you think now that we have had an adequate conversation among those disparate interests such that we can say that at least from a societal standpoint, people are talking to each other? Or are we not even there yet, in your view?
Well, that's a difficult one because the internet refers to so many different applications. So
fair enough.
Some are getting more attention than others. I'm happy to see, you know, more attention being paid to some of the considerations such as privacy. But I would say probably we aren't having an adequate conversation, though we certainly are beginning to have some conversation around these issues. And there are quite a few universities now that have centers to study the information society and how it impacts, or at least the legal oversight of the information society. So that's one where we've perhaps taken some significant steps forward, but I think, you know, if we had time, that's one you could go into great detail and analyze each facet of it and what's truly getting attention and what isn't getting attention. For example, the privacy issue is one that everybody flags, but I don't think it's being handled very well.
How much of what is written in the popular press on the kinds of technological introductions that you talk about in the book is accurate? Because you mentioned the issue of politics, but there's also the issue of sensationalism and eyeballs. And so take your example that you mentioned earlier involving the threat to employment as a result of technology. That threat, if taken seriously, should raise alarm bells if let's say half the population could lose their jobs. And yet it seems like the glut of information that's out there, particularly clickbait and the willingness of increasingly of media outlets to write headlines with a view towards getting eyeballs as opposed to accurately reflecting what's there, would mitigate against people taking these risks seriously. Again, recognizing the broad range of issues that we're discussing here, how confident are you in the reporting that goes on about these issues?
Well, again, they're reporters and they're reporters. So there's a very irresponsible press out there, but there's also a good number of reporters who are trying to be responsible. The difficulty is whether they understand the issues that they're reporting on well enough. And then there's also the simple fact that you need to capture eyeballs, you need to sell newspapers, you need to capture people listening to reports. So we all get into a little bit of sensationalism. The question is, what's responsible and what isn't? In general, it's the people who raise either the hype, either in terms of simplistically pushing the benefits of technology or the fears simplistically pushing what can go wrong to get the most attention. And we don't seem to have a culture that values good faith brokers, and therefore we don't have a culture that necessarily wants reports from people who are trying to give a balanced expression of what's going on. So just for an example, there was this story just a few days ago about a worker in a VW factory who got crushed by an industrial robot. At least that's what we know about it so far. But basically, the headlines are all, it was killed by a robot, as if a robot made some intentional action to kill, or that this was the first dawning of the, you know, of the grand singularity where smart robots were going to take out humans. And that, I think that was irresponsible. On the other hand, that's what captured eyeballs. Again, there's been segments of my book that have been published online recently in which the headlines sometimes were a little bit more dramatic than anything that I'd actually said in these segments that were being talked about. So this is a very difficult thing for the press and will continue to be so until readers or viewers or the public in general really cries out to have some good faith brokers, some people who are giving a more balanced stance, and looks to them first.
And this is where, actually, right after our very short break, that I want to go in terms of the procedural aspects of these concerns before we close the interview with some suggestions that you talk about at the end of the book about how to deal with these things. You're listening to KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. We're chatting with Wendell Wallach, author of the new book, A Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control. As always, for those that listen regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the station and to Hearsay Culture. So let me ask you this question, which I think ties directly into the concerns you just raised about certain press publicity involving your book. You raised the concern, and I think quite frankly, some who weren't reading your book but might try to classically judge a book by its cover would say that this is just another fatalistic view of technology proffered by this particular author. I think anyone that reads the book knows that that would not be the case, but right there is a prevalent view that technologies are already out of our control. In fact, when I was reviewing your book, Wendell, in preparation for today, after I'd read it, I happened to be reading it, and a someone I know came by, said, "What are you reading?" I showed the cover, and this person just kind of jokingly said, "Yep, it already is. It's already beyond our control." How do you deal with that perception, which is kind of the first question, and then I want to follow up with a discussion a bit of Moore's Law and intelligence explosion as you define it. But how concerned are you about a fatalistic view of technology? Because, of course, if people already think it's out of our control, then people are going to give up.
Exactly, and that's what concerns me the most, is that we're about to abdicate responsibility for our own lives and think that, well, whatever becomes technologically feasible is going to be implemented largely because it serves somebody's benefit and somebody can make money off of it. And I truly understand where that attitude comes from, but I'm trying to show that there have been times in the development of technologies, even recently, where we've acted on inflection points and have altered the course of technological development. That doesn't mean we've stopped developments as much as we've altered how the technologies will develop. And the earlier you can take some action to adjust or make a course adjustment, then the destination where that technology will head could be vastly different than it would have been if you hadn't taken that action. So let's just take one simple example. The deciphering of the human genome is a dramatic inflection point in human history, which will have all kinds of ramifications that we can't even accurately estimate at this stage of history. But just 2 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court had to make a decision about whether the human genes could or could not be patented. And nobody knew before that decision what they would do. There was pressures on them to allow genes to be patented, commercial pressures on them to do so. And yet they decided that the human genome could not be patented. And by that one decision, they altered the overall course of development in genomics.
And in your view, because we do discuss IP on this show pretty regularly, that decision, which ultimately, just to put it in general terms, prevented ownership interest entering into the innovation process, has led to what effects that you've identified so far?
Well, one effect is that researchers are now freer to get access to material that might have been patented by others, and therefore research and work with that material without having to pay onerous overhead to the companies that claim to control those genes. So that's just one simple example of what's taking place. On the other hand, it may have even slowed down development in another way, in that corporations will be less willing to put large bucks into genetic research if they don't feel they can control the results of that research.
So, Wendell, let me ask you this as we kind of pivot to some of these concerns you have on a procedural side. You know, when we're talking about these complex technologies, as you mentioned at the beginning, you know, there is a role for experts here. In other words, no one could reasonably expect the public to be able to understand or have the time, for that matter, to understand these complex technologies, and yet some kind of decision has to be made. I've chatted recently with Stephen Turner, who's written about expertise in policymaking. I'm curious to get your view. Who or what is an expert in these areas, and what is the precise role of experts in dealing with these issues?
Well, I think experts is a pretty difficult term. Obviously, there are people with specialized knowledge that you and I don't have. The physicists in dealing with the Large Hadron Collider issue we're able to make a kind of analysis that most of the public didn't even understand what the issue was, let alone how to make that kind of analysis. So we definitely need experts to make certain kinds of decisions, or at least give certain kinds of inputs. But particularly when you're talking about technologies that will have a societal impact, the expert, there is no one who is an expert in societal impact. There is no one who has the value system that should be applied to all circumstances. And therefore, I don't think there really is an expert. I think you need input from all kinds of concerned parties and stakeholders. And the real challenge is, how do you get that input? How is it managed, and who oversees it, and how is it represented to either policymakers or the public so that they can make an informed decision about what should proceed or what should not proceed forward? And when I say proceed forward, I don't necessarily mean that we say no to a particular technology, but for example, we might say no to public investment in that technology. Or we might say that corporations have a right to proceed, but they need to know upfront that there will be these restrictions on any discovery they make and their ability to capitalize on that discovery.
The world of experts, of course, includes academics, and it's certainly relevant to this show. What is the role of academics in trying to navigate the policy concerns that you raise in the book?
Well, this is a pretty difficult one, because academics often live very much within their own silos, and those silos may be scientific silos, or those silos may be policy silos, but they very seldom have the broad, comprehensive overview of technological development or of a particular technology. And though we talk about the desire for more interdisciplinary expertise, very few academics actually get rewarded for having those expertise. So it's not like we're encouraging people to take a comprehensive view. So again, the scholars, the academics, they become experts who can bring kinds of knowledge to bear on the final decision making that perhaps others don't have, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they should be the decision makers. On the other hand, there are a lot of academics out there who are trying to wave some red flags and say, look at this, this is problematic, and they get ignored. So that's not helpful either.
This is a bit of inside baseball, but there are plenty of academics that listen, so I'm going to ask it. Right, institutionally, I tend to agree with you. Do you see that the potential of these technologies changing even how the educational endeavor works? In other words, as you know, right, online education is growing, and it's causing concerns about the very jobs that you referred to earlier, not to mention the pedagogical ability of technology to convey information and create learning environments that the classic classroom does. Do you have any opinion on whether the fact that technology is impacting education itself could wind up being a militating factor against the challenges of academics to write in an interdisciplinary way in this area, or is that just pie in the sky?
Well, I think I don't think that per se necessarily puts a downward pressure on either they're writing interdisciplinarily or not writing interdisciplinarily. And I think probably the term I would like to use is transdisciplinary, not just between two or more fields, but trying to think broadly about the issues at hand. I think what's important here is that this gets valued by either those on the internet looking for information, or that the colleges and universities begin to recognize they have a real problem here, that the kind of expertise they're developing and the kind of ways they're encouraging educational development don't necessarily create the young people with the ability to think and raise critical issues across a broader range of different fields.
We're chatting with Wendell Wallach, author of the book A Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So you know, as we think about these broad challenges, we have the institutional challenges of the sensationalism that you mentioned, the fact that politics are involved. Now we've added institutional barriers and even discouragement of serious scholarly study in these areas. So let's pile on, Wendell, and I don't mean to suggest that your book is negative, because I don't think it is, but you definitely are raising a lot of alarm bells here on how to deal with this dangerous master. I mentioned earlier Moore's Law and intelligence explosion. What are those concepts for those that are unfamiliar, and how optimistic are you in our ability to deal with the reality of those?
Well, Moore's Law was the discovery very early in the development of semi-processors, that computing power doubled. Originally, it thought to double every 24 months, but it's now been revised to every 18 months. And it seems to have held true for quite a few decades. There's issues about whether it will continue to hold through, hold true. But for all practical purposes, it's held true. It is at least held true as a goal for the companies that make the semi-processors. And why it gets a lot of attention is this notion that eventually the power of computers may reach and then far surpass what is seen as the computing power of human intelligence. Now, whether human intelligence can fully be reduced to this computational model of its computing power, that's an issue for neuroscientists, but there's a lot of computer scientists who believe that it can. And once we have that capacity with computers, then computers will not only achieve human-level intelligence, but then in an intelligence explosion, they will create more and more sophisticated computers until what we have is known as superintelligence, or some people refer to this as a technological singularity, when the world changes in so many radical ways that we can't even perceive what that will be. And of course, this has been the stuff of science fiction, particularly the bad scenarios, the Terminator-like or Matrix scenarios, in which these super smart forms of artificial intelligence do not see that the continuation of humans is in their self-interest.
So let me go back to what you said earlier about understanding the reasons why people have a fatalistic view of technology. What do you see as the reasons why people tend to have that view? Is it because of what they're being told? Is it a societal view of the role of technology? Is it something different? Where do you place the reasons for the view that, for all of the reasons we just mentioned and that you write about in detail in the book, right, there's no reason to even bother trying to control this stuff?
Well, I do think it gets quite complicated, and it's not necessarily about technology per se, but people often feel powerless even in trying to resist those things that they have tried to alter or resist. I also think that at least for more conservative members of our society, there's a feeling that there's kind of a scientific hegemony that rides roughshod over their beliefs, and they're seeing that it seems to be succeeding, at least in terms of replacing the belief systems that have informed more conservatively oriented folks of conservative Christian persuasion, for example, for quite a few decades. So that's part of the story here. But I think the story is also that technology serves big economic interests. So if you can outline that it has benefits, there's very little resistance to its development on our society, particularly with this political notion that technology will and always will serve humanity's benefits, and that it increases productivity and therefore should not be slowed down in any way, shape, or form. So we have these notions like techno-solutionism, that there'll be a technological fix for any technological problem. We have these notions we've had for decades that technology will lower healthcare costs, but the reality is it never has, and in fact is one of the main contributors to healthcare budgets that are growing totally out of control. So there's just some assumptions in there, there's some beliefs in there, but I think overall it fits into a broader sense that we don't have much control and that our political leaders are so entrenched that trying to give structure to our society in positive ways is looked at myopically and focuses more on issues of productivity but not issues of quality of life.
So we're recording on July 7th, 2015. We're chatting with Wendell Wallach, author of the book A Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control. Wendell, you mentioned a connection which I think is a very interesting one and worth spending a little more time on, recognizing that we're now at what I call the unfair portion of the show, where I started asking you questions that you may not have, in your view, adequate time to answer effectively, and then I ask them anyway. We're still, as it's July 7th, and I think we're going to be dealing with this for a while, as a society, the after effects of the Supreme Court's ruling effectively legalizing gay marriage by making it illegal under the Constitution to prevent the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender individuals from being married. And if I'm understanding your allusion to religious conservatives correctly, there is some there's actually more than some pushback against that position, and we've heard arguments that what the Supreme Court has done is vitiate the ability of people of that of those spiritual beliefs to practice their religion, and therefore this is government takeover. Is that the connection that you see as far as this fatalistic view that there is a sense through those kinds of behaviors that things are going to happen regardless of people's views? Or is there more to what I think is a very interesting insight that you've identified?
Well, I think there's much more to it. I just use that as a kind of example. I mean, you can think of, in the same terms as you can think of the frustration of gay people for decades that they weren't able to move the dime very easily. And suddenly we've had this inflection point. Suddenly we've had this tipping point, and almost overnight their concerns are getting addressed. So I think this is always the difficult thing of, you know, we're frustrated in this society's ability to move until suddenly it does move, and then we're overjoyed, presuming that it moves in the way we want it to, and we feel that we're in a futile situation if it doesn't move in the way we wanted it to. So I'm just sort of underlining that as part of this broader narrative that says what can be developed will be developed, particularly if it serves somebody's economic interest, and therefore the ability of new technological possibilities to redefine human life, in some cases perhaps even invent what it means to be human as we've known it out of existence, particularly if there is progress made toward artificial intelligence or toward manipulation of the human genome or towards neuroprosthetics or neuropharmacology, that's drugs or devices being used to enhance our mental capabilities. So there is this sense, I think, among many people that all of this will come to pass and they will have little or no input into what gets embraced and what does not get embraced. Is that true? Well, there are viewpoints that it's only getting embraced because there's a lot of consumers who want these things. Mm-hmm.
So, Wendell, as we, you know, as we close in on about 6 minutes left in the interview, I'd be remiss in not asking you, given all the concerns that you've raised in the book, you're not leaving the reader with "and all is hopeless," but rather you close the book with some suggestions on how to, or potential solutions to these problems. Run through them quickly, and which ones do you think have the most political currency and which don't?
Okay, good. Well, I mean, you know, I'm actually, believe it or not, sort of an optimist that if we flag these things, people will start to give them attention and will mitigate some of the concerns that I have. But the last five chapters of the book really do go into various ways of proceeding. One is to challenge assumptions. So that's assumptions such as that technology will lower healthcare costs, or technology will raise productivity and therefore the availability of jobs. I think those are false assumptions. The second one is to block the development of forms of artificial intelligence that undermine the core principle that there is a human who is responsible and potentially culpable and liable for the technologies that we bring into place. I'm very concerned that autonomous systems, and in particular lethal autonomy, killer robots, will do that. So I think we should resist any movement in that direction. The third area is what I call engineering for responsibility, and that's to put as much money into looking at ways to manage the risks as in developing the technologies. There's very little funding that goes into managing the risks. This is something that has been just underscored in artificial intelligence, and it's also a problem in synthetic biology right now. So it's nice to see responsible scientists come forward and say there's some real risks with the technologies we're introducing, and we need to be putting money into seeing whether we can manage them technologically, if not by other means. And finally, I do put forward a broad policy recommendation, one that I developed together with Gary Marchant. Gary is the head of the Center for Law and Innovation at Arizona State University, Sandra Day O'Connor School of Law. And we have been looking at the oversight of emerging technologies and wanted to think through what was needed. And we came up with this idea of governance coordinating committees, largely good faith brokers that try and stay on top of what's occurring, listen to all the stakeholders, look for gaps in the existing mechanisms and whether there are ways to plug those gaps, preferably ways that are sometimes referred to as soft governance. So this means non-governmental regulatory methods such as professional codes of ethics or industry standards, and if possible, utilize them. But if not possible, bring to the attention to the legislature that there is some area in which we need some regulation or oversight. We understand that creating something new like this would be very difficult in the present political climate, and therefore some people would consider us a bit naive. But we think that something like this is truly necessary, and usually when it's seen that something is necessary, we can find ways of working through the very difficult challenges that loom ahead. So I bring in these broad array of different ways of addressing the challenges of technology, wrestling control away from that, wrestling control back or putting it in our hands. And all of this is in context of keeping our eyes open for the various inflection points, those occasions when we can truly intervene and alter the course of the technology. But if technological development is truly accelerating, it's speeding up the way it appears to be, then that often gets in the way of oversight. Things move too quickly for us to address the problems that we begin to perceive. And that's what concerns me the most, that we'll have a confluence of different tragedies occurring simultaneously that could indeed undermine the legitimacy of our society.
So, Wendell, on that, you know, very concerning note, let me ask you this final question, although maybe you've answered it. So, you know, you this is a book written for a broad audience, but obviously I'm sure you want policymakers to be reading this book. If there was one core message that you'd want policymakers to take from your book, what would it be?
So I would say don't deal with the emerging technologies cavalierly. There are not just benefits, but there are also risks, and we need to look more closely at the trade-off. And it's about time that we got around to putting effective yet flexible oversight in place. And that's what I'd want our policy planners to understand, but I think they're only going to deal with it if there's a critical mass of citizens who understand that and push them to address it.
And are there individual elected officials at least at the national level, even international level, that you think are the thought and emerging leaders in regulating technologies?
Not really. I mean, I know of a few people in government who would like to give more attention to these issues. The closest thing we have to this is the Office of Science and Technology Policy within the White House. And they do try and think about these concerns in a comprehensive manner, but they're under a lot of other pressures to put in place new initiatives and they don't necessarily get the political background to be able to move forward their concerns. So I would say, you know, we have people within government who care. That doesn't mean they're able to do much.
Wendell Wallach, author of the book A Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control. Fascinating book, eminently readable. Thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. I certainly invite you back. As you note, we're at the beginning of this story. Certainly, I think you've offered possibilities for how to deal with these issues. Let's hope that we have the wisdom to adopt them and think them through. Thank you much for educating my listeners today.
Thank you ever so much, Dave, for the great questions and the opportunity to talk about this in depth.
My pleasure. We have a number of guests coming up on Hearsay Culture this quarter. As I've posted on Hearsay Culture's website, I'm doing a slightly truncated schedule this summer because, as I've noted, law review articles don't write themselves, and so I'm going to do a few fewer interviews than I normally do. But having said that, I'm very excited about the guests that I have coming on. Among them coming up is Jason Arnold, author of Secrecy in the Sunshine Era. Additionally, Natasha Shull, author of Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas. Professor Jackie Lipton, author of the book Rethinking Cyber Law. Margot Kaminsky of Ohio State University College of Law on International Trade and Surveillance. And Lorelei Kelly on Legislative Decision Making. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show live Fridays at 3 p.m. Pacific Time on KZSU by tuning in either at 90.1 FM if you're in the Bay Area, or kzsufmlive.stanford.edu for streaming. You can also get the show via podcast by going to the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, or to the web at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by the newly redesigned Hearsay Culture website at hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous 240 almost shows, as well as the upcoming schedule. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com, or you could in fact tweet to hearsayculture.com by going to Twitter at hearsayculture, or by reaching me via the contact page at hearsayculture.com. Thank you for listening today to the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.